Good morning and welcome to Flight Logic Brief. It's Tuesday, July 14th, 2026. I'm Alex.
And I'm Sam. Bastille Day, by the way. So if any of you are trying to get into Paris this morning, good luck.
Yeah, we'll get to that. There's some fun stuff out of the fly past. But Sam, we've got to lead with the big one today, because I think this is genuinely a milestone story.
Supersonic.
The Federal Aviation Administration's proposed rulemaking on a noise standard that would lift the decades-old ban on supersonic flight over U.S. land.
Finally. I mean, that ban's been on the books since, what, the 70s?
1973. And now Spike Aerospace has come out and said they're accelerating development of the S-512, their supersonic business jet, directly because of this proposal.
Okay, but hold on. Accelerating is doing a lot of work in that sentence. Source, Aviation Week Bazav.
Well, that's the debate, right? Aviation Week's analysis piece basically frames the whole industry as split on whether the rule change alone is enough to actually spawn a supersonic business jet.
And it isn't. I'll just say it. Look, lifting the overland ban is huge. Don't get me wrong, that's the thing everyone's been waiting on for 50 years. But a noise standard for the boom is not the same thing as a certified airplane with an engine that exists.
Right, that's the piece people forget. There's no off-the-shelf supersonic-capable power plant for a jet this size.
None. And that's been the graveyard for every one of these programs. Remember Aerion? Backed by Boeing money, huge order book on paper, and it folded in 21 because they couldn't close the propulsion gap. So when Spike says they're accelerating, my question is, accelerating toward what exactly?
The counterargument, though, is that a regulatory green light unlocks the investment case. If you can't fly supersonic over land, your addressable market for a business jet is basically transoceanic only, and that's a tiny sliver.
That's fair. That's totally fair. Overland is where the money is, the transcon runs, New York to LA. That's the mission that sells. So the rule changes the math on the demand side. I want people listening to understand this is a 5 to 10 year story minimum, not a book your seat story.
And the boom standard itself matters. It's not zero boom. It's a defined acceptable noise level, and the airplane has to be designed to meet it.
Which shapes the whole airframe. That's the Lockheed X-59 low boom stuff, the long pointy nose, the whole shaped signature approach. If your jet can't hit the number, the overland permission does you no good.
So bottom line, momentum is real, but temper it.
Temper it. It's a green light at the start of a very long runway. But it's a green light and we haven't had one of those in a long time.
Speaking of the business jet market though, there's a certification win that's a lot more concrete. Embraer's Praetor 500E has secured global certification.
Now that's a real airplane you can go buy today.
Exactly. Mid-cabin segment, and this reinforces just how competitive that space has gotten. The 500E slots right into a segment that's arguably the hottest part of the market.
It is the hottest part. Super mid-size and mid-cabin, that's where the fractional operators are putting their money. That's where the charter demand is. Embraer's been eating into territory that used to be all Cessna and Bombardier.
And global certification means they can deliver into multiple regions without the drag of chasing individual validations one at a time.
Which for an operator is the whole ballgame. Fleet planning, residual values, financing, it all gets easier when the type's cleared everywhere. Good news for anybody flying that airplane or thinking about it.
Now here's one that's going to hit operators right in the wallet. SpaceX has doubled its Starlink service prices for business aviation.
Wait, doubled?
Doubled. The entry-level business jet 20-gigabyte plan goes from $2,000 a month to $4,000. And they doubled the unlimited plan, too. Plus, they're introducing regional pricing tiers.
Okay, that's a big deal, and I don't think it's getting enough attention. Starlink came in and basically blew up the in-flight connectivity market, right? Everybody rushed to install it because it was fast and cheap compared to the legacy geostationary providers.
Gogo, Viasat, the incumbents.
Right, and Starlink undercut them dramatically. So now you've got a big installed base of operators who've committed to the hardware and SpaceX turns around and doubles the subscription. That's a classic move.
Land and expand, then raise prices once you've got the base locked in.
Exactly that. And the switching cost is real. You've paid for the antenna, the install, the supplemental type certificate to put it on the airframe. You're not going to rip it out over a price increase overnight.
So what does an operator do here? Just eat it?
In the short term, mostly yeah. But I think what you'll see is the flight departments that were about to pull the trigger on Starlink taking a beat, reassessing, maybe looking at whether the legacy guys have gotten more competitive. And for the charter operators, this is a cost they're going to have to pass through. Connectivity is not optional anymore. The passengers expect it.
It's become a checklist item for the whole cabin experience.
It's table stakes. So this is a real line item increase for anybody managing a fleet, and I'd want it on my radar for budget season.
Let's cross the Atlantic for a second, because Italy's ENAC has launched a regional air mobility network project, and this one's actually operational, not conceptual.
Oh, interesting. So they're past the demo stage?
Past the demo stage. ENAC's in-house entity, ENAC Servizi Aeroporti, is standing up a network with first commercial flights scheduled by year-end out of Rome Urb Airport. And Technom's regional airline spinoff, Altair, is in the mix.
Now, this is the kind of thing I love because it's the unglamorous version of the future everybody hypes. Everyone wants to talk about electric air taxis and flying cars. And meanwhile, the actual near-term regional mobility play is small conventional aircraft, like the Technam P1012 Traveler, flying real routes.
The Traveler's a 9 or 11-seat class airplane, right?
Something in that range. Yeah, purpose-built for exactly this. Thin regional routes connecting secondary airports, the stuff that doesn't justify a regional jet or even a turboprop like an ATR. And the reason it matters for our audience is the certification pathway.
How so?
Because Europe's working out the regulatory framework for these small aircraft commercial networks in real time, and that framework tends to migrate. What ENAC figures out about operating these things commercially, the rules, the pilot requirements, the operational approvals, that becomes a template. It's worth watching even if you're flying a Gulfstream and couldn't care less about a 9-seater.
And Rome Urbe as the launch point is interesting. That's the little downtownish field, not Fiumicino.
Which is the whole point, right? Regional mobility is about using the airports the big carriers ignore. Smart choice.
One more quick one from the Aviation Week group, and this is just a nice palate cleanser. Cape Air has unveiled a 250th anniversary livery.
For the Declaration of Independence 2026, right? The semi-quincentennial.
Look at you with the word. Red, white, and blue. Custom painted on a Cessna 402C piston twin.
A 402, that's such a Cape Air move. Everybody else does the anniversary livery on a wide body, and Cape Air's like, no, we're going to put it on the little Cessna twin that actually built this airline.
It's a flying tribute, and honestly, good on them. The 402's an icon of that whole Cape Cod island hopping operation.
It really is. And hey, there's a whole generation of regional and airline pilots who built their first hundreds of hours in a Cape Air 402. So a little sentimental value there too. For us, Google News.
Let's talk maintenance for a minute. A couple of MRO items crossing the wire. First, JCB Aero over in France completed maintenance on an ACJ319 and an ACJ320.
The Airbus corporate jet variants, the VIP configured A319 and A320.
Right, JCB's the specialist based near Bordeaux in Mérignac. And these are the big money private conversions, the head of state ultra high net worth airplanes.
Yeah, and the reason completing an ACJ check is a headline at all is the interiors. When you're doing heavy maintenance on one of these, you're not just working the airframe. You've got a bespoke cabin in there worth more than the airplane in some cases. Gold-plated fixtures, custom cabinetry, the whole thing. Pulling that apart and putting it back together is genuinely specialized work.
And it dovetails with the second one. ExecuJet MRO Services Belgium just got approved to perform maintenance on the Dassault Falcon 6X.
The 6X. That's one of the newest large cabin jets out there, only been in service a couple of years.
So this is about building out the service network for a relatively new type.
And that's the story underneath both of these. When you operate a business jet, service network coverage is a real operational consideration. If your 6X goes tech in Europe, you want an approved facility close by, not a ferry flight back to France. So every new authorization like this quietly improves dispatch reliability for operators of that type. It's plumbing. But it's important plumbing.
Plumbing that keeps the airplanes flying.
Exactly.
So switching gears a bit, if you're heading to Oshkosh next week, the National Business Aviation Association is going to have a big presence at AirVenture.
Oh, it's that time already? Wow, this year's flying.
July 20th through the 26th at Whitman Regional. The NBAA is running a tent, Tent 432, near the flight line, plus exhibit space. And they're there to connect with members and talk up the association benefits.
It's a little bit of a role reversal, right? AirVenture's the Experimental Aircraft Association show. It's the grassroots home-built Warbird general aviation mecca. And here's the Business Aviation Association setting up shop.
But it makes sense when you think about the pipeline.
It makes total sense. Where do you think the business jet pilots of 2040 come from? A lot of them are 17 years old wandering the flight line at Oshkosh right now. The NBAA showing up there is partly advocacy, partly recruitment, partly just reminding everybody that business aviation and grassroots aviation are the same ecosystem.
And there's real policy overlap too, the stuff NBAA fights for, airspace access, tax treatment, that affects the whole community.
It does. And honestly, if you're going, go find Tent 432 and talk to them. Whether you're Part 91, 135, whatever, that's your advocacy organization in Washington. Worth a handshake.
All right, and we should mention, our friends over at Professional Pilot Magazine, their August question feature is out, though. We're going to be honest. All we got in the feed was the copyright notice, set to source Professional Pilot.
Yeah, we're not going to pretend we read an article that was just a copyright line.
No, but Professional Pilot's monthly reader question feature is always worth a look if you subscribe. They poll working pilots on operational and career topics. So go check the August issue for the real thing.
We just don't have it to analyze this morning. Moving on.
Okay, let's get into the forums, because there's a couple of items out of the pilot community this morning that I think are genuinely worth a professional conversation. And Sam, I want to start with a scary one.
Uh-oh.
A pilot posted about a Cessna 182 on a new company route, a camera and survey operation. Pilot weighs 235 pounds, the camera operator weighs 400 pounds, and the airplane is roughly 160 pounds over maximum takeoff weight.
Okay, stop. That's not a Reddit post. That's an incident report waiting to happen.
Right? And the pilot flagged it, which, credit to them for raising it.
Credit for raising it, but the answer here is not complicated. You don't fly the airplane. That's it. 160 pounds over gross in a 182 is not a rounding error. That's a serious margin. And on a survey mission, you're probably doing low-level maneuvering, orbits, steep turns over the target.
Which is exactly the flight regime where being overweight bites you.
It's the worst possible combination. Degraded climb performance, higher stall speed, and you're maneuvering low and slow to begin with. If you lose the engine or you need to out-climb terrain, the performance just isn't there. And the certificate margins, the structural margins, they assume you're at or below gross.
And there's a professional dimension here too, because this is a company route. There's an employer involved.
That's the part that makes my blood boil a little. Because this pilot is being put in a position by an operator, and the pressure to just make it work is real. But this is a textbook case for the pilot in command authority. You are the final authority for the operation of that aircraft, full stop. And if the mission requires flying over gross, the mission needs to change, not the physics.
So what's the fix? A bigger airplane?
Bigger airplane, or split the load, or a 206, a 210, something with the payload for a 400-pound operator plus gear. There are airplanes that can do this mission legally. A 182 with that load is not one of them. And I'd add, document that you raised it. Because if this operator's asking one pilot to fly over gross, they're asking others too.
That's a really good point. This is a cultural red flag about the operation, not just one flight.
Exactly. One overgross flight is a mistake. A company route built around an overgross airplane is a systemic problem.
All right, related theme, sort of, the enforcement side. There was a thread that I thought was a great question. Somebody asked, when air traffic control says, I've got a number for you to call, what actually happens then? And what if the pilot just chooses not to call?
Oh, the phone number. The dreaded phone number.
The dreaded phone number. Walk everybody through it.
So first off, hearing that transmission is not automatically the end of the world, but it does mean something got somebody's attention. Usually it's a possible deviation. You busted an altitude, you clipped some airspace, you had a loss of separation, a pilot deviation of some kind, and the controller is telling you the facility wants to talk to you.
And the what if I don't call part?
Here's the thing people misunderstand. Not calling doesn't make it go away. The controller has already noted it. There's likely a recording, there's radar data. The phone call is actually the informal, lowest level way to resolve it. A lot of the time you call, you have a conversation, they explain what they saw, and it ends right there. It never becomes anything.
So the call is your friend in a weird way.
The call is often your friend, yeah. Now, you're not required to incriminate yourself, and if you think something serious is going on, you're within your rights to be measured, get some advice, maybe talk to your union or an aviation attorney before you say a lot. But blowing it off entirely, that just removes the easy off-ramp and leaves the formal process, which is worse.
And this is where the Aviation Safety Reporting System comes in, right? The NASA form.
Yes, huge. If you think you may have deviated, file the NASA Aviation Safety Reporting System report promptly within 10 days. It doesn't erase a violation, but for an inadvertent, non-deliberate deviation, it can give you immunity from the civil penalty or certificate suspension. It's one of the best protections a pilot has, and it's free.
File the report, make the call, be professional.
File the report, make the call, be honest, don't be a jerk to the controller. 9 times out of 10, it's a nothing burger.
Now on a much lighter note, and this is the fun one. Our Reddit feed is full of Bastille Day flypast photos this morning.
Oh, it's the best day for plane spotting in Europe, hands down.
The July 14th parade over the Champs-Élysées. People posting shots of the A400M, Rafales, the Breguet Atlantique, Mirage 2000s, the whole French Air and Space Force lineup.
The Atlantique, that's a cool one to see. That's the Maritime Patrol turboprop. You don't get eyes on those every day. And the Patrouille de France with the tricolor smoke, I mean, come on.
But here's the item that made me laugh, and it's a real operational note. There was a post from someone watching traffic inbound to Paris Charles de Gaulle, holding, because of the aerial celebrations.
Yeah, and the caption was something like, "Hope the passengers can watch it on the in-flight entertainment, otherwise it's going to be a long wait."
Which, when you think about it, is a genuine operational reality. You've got a major military flypast over central Paris, and it ripples into the airspace, and the arrival flows at one of Europe's busiest airports.
It absolutely does. Temporary flight restrictions, airspace closures, holding, the works. And this is a planned annual event, so the flow managers know it's coming. But if you're a crew flying into de Gaulle on the morning of the 14th, that's a fuel planning conversation. You want extra holding fuel, you want your alternate sorted, because the ground stops and the delays are predictable.
It's a good reminder that national ceremonies are an operational input, not just a spectacle.
Right, and it's not just France. Think about major events anywhere, state funerals, big air shows, presidential movements in the US with the temporary flight restrictions. The pretty flypast for the crowd is a no-tam headache for the working crew. Both things are true at once.
Both things are true. Now, the forums this time of year are also just flooded with the career and training pipeline stuff, and there were a bunch of really recurring themes I want to touch on quickly.
The perennial ones.
The perennial ones. Incoming college freshmen asking, should I even try to be a pilot, staring down a $70,000 Part 141 program. Somebody asking why the community hates loans and accelerated express schools. A CFI with a conditional job offer, wondering whether to go get the instrument instructor rating while they wait for a class date.
So there's a real mood shift in these threads, and I've noticed it. A couple years ago, 22, 23, the vibe was, get your ratings as fast as humanly possible. The airlines are starving for pilots, hurry. And now?
Now the tone's more cautious.
Much more cautious. You've got that freshman worried about financing 70 grand into an uncertain hiring environment, and honestly, that caution is healthy. The hiring wave crested. It's not a bad time to become a pilot, but the sign any loan, the airlines will bail you out in 18 months era is over.
So on the accelerated school and loans question, where do you land?
The math the express school defenders use isn't wrong on paper, right? Finish faster, start earning at the airline sooner. The earlier income supposedly justifies the higher cost. The problem is the assumptions. Accelerated training assumes no weather delays, no check ride failures, no hiring slowdown, and a smooth pipeline. Real life has all of those. So the skepticism isn't anti-fast training, it's anti-fragile plan.
And the CFI with the conditional offer, go get the instrument instructor rating or not?
If you've already passed the written and you've got 2 to 6 months to kill before your class date, yeah, go get the instrument instructor certificate. You'll build hours instructing, instrument students are steady work, and it makes you more employable if the class date slips, which, see my earlier point, class dates slip. It's a low-risk, high-return move in that window.
And there was a nice one in there, too. Somebody who just passed their private pilot check ride and reflected that their biggest obstacle wasn't stick and rudder. It was perfectionism and not analyzing the situation well enough.
That's such a mature takeaway, and it doesn't go away. That's the same lesson at the type rating level, at the check airman level. Aviation punishes the perfectionist who freezes and rewards the person who assesses, decides, and moves on. Good on that new private pilot for seeing it early.
One last quick one from the community, and it's an industry item buried in the Reddit feed. Catalina Aircraft is pushing ahead with an updated Catalina 2 after securing a 46 aircraft commitment.
The amphibian, right? The modernized flying boat.
Right, and 46 airframes is a real commitment for a niche platform.
It is, and I think there's a genuine market reawakening for amphibious and utility aircraft. Firefighting, remote area logistics, island operations, coastal patrol. It's a small segment, but it's persistent and it's underserved. So a modernized Catalina with a real order book behind it, that's not nothing. I'll be curious to see if they can actually get it into production, because that's always the hard part for these boutique programs.
Execution risk, same as our supersonic friends.
Same story, different corner of the industry, source Simple Flying.
Let's do a lap through the airline and industry side. There's a bunch of good stuff here. Start with a regulatory economic story, because I think it's undercovered. There's a rule quietly forcing United's Boeing 737-200s into the desert.
Oh, the emissions trading story?
Exactly. European carbon policy, specifically the full phase-out of free aviation emissions allowances under the EU emissions trading system, starting this year, 2026. It's making older, thirstier aircraft more expensive to operate, and United's accelerating retirement of its aging 737-200s.
And this is the thing. It's not a fuel tax exactly, it's subtler than that. For years, airlines got a bunch of their carbon allowances for free. Now those free allowances are going away. So if you're burning more fuel per seat, you're buying more carbon permits, and that cost lands hardest on your oldest, least efficient metal.
So the old 777-200 that was fully depreciated and cheap to keep flying?
Suddenly isn't so cheap, yeah. The economics flip. And it's fascinating because it's regulation reshaping fleet decisions without ever grounding an airplane directly. The market just makes the old jet uneconomic and it drifts off to the desert. You'll see more of this. Any carrier with aging wide bodies flying European routes is running these numbers right now.
And on the flip side of the wide body story, the A380 is having a moment. Two items. Qantas is about to get its whole A380 fleet back to full strength, 10 aircraft, and there was this rare London Heathrow to Los Angeles ferry flight of one of them, VHOQG.
A direct Heathrow to LA on an A380 with, I assume, basically no payload? That's a fun ferry flight.
Right, coming off a long maintenance saga. And meanwhile, British Airways is doubling down, deploying its 12 A380s on 8 high-capacity Heathrow routes.
And the BA logic is airtight, actually. Heathrow is slot-constrained, brutally so. You physically cannot add more frequencies. There are no slots. So if demand on a route exceeds what you can serve with the frequencies you've got, your only lever is a bigger airplane. And the A380, 469 seats, is the biggest lever there is.
So the slot constraint is what keeps the Super Jumbo alive.
It's the whole reason. Air France, Lufthansa, they walked away from the A380. But at a slot-choked hub like Heathrow, the economics work because you're not competing on frequency. You're competing on capacity per slot. It's a very specific niche, and BA's found it.
Let's talk cabins for a second, because Delta dropped some interesting news on their earnings call. Their incoming Boeing 787-10s are going to have over 50% premium seating.
50%? That's wild. That's more than double what they've got on the 767s. These are replacing.
Right. The 767s were around 30% premium mix. Delta's chief commercial officer confirmed the 787-10s will be over half premium, and they're rolling out this basic business class product.
So this is the big structural shift in the industry, and it's real. The money's up front now. Premium cabins, premium economy, the whole front of the airplane is subsidizing the back and increasingly outselling the back on the routes that matter. Delta's essentially saying the transatlantic traveler will pay for comfort. So let's build the airplane around that.
And this basic business class idea, unbundling the front cabin the way they unbundled economy?
That's exactly what it is. And it's a little dystopian if you think too hard about it. You've got a business class seat, but now there's a stripped down fare for it. Segment the premium cabin the way they segmented coach. Some travelers will love the cheaper entry point. Some will feel nickel and dimed. But commercially, it lets Delta capture a wider range of willingness to pay in the same cabin.
For our corporate flight department listeners, this matters when you're building travel policy for the folks who aren't on the company jet.
Good point, yeah. If your executives are flying commercial on the transatlantic, understanding this basic versus full business class split is going to matter for your travel management and your negotiated corporate fares.
All right, couple of pilot interest quick hits from this group. There's a piece on how much Air Force fighter pilots actually make.
And the answer surprises people every time.
It does. Base salary ranges from about $49,800 for a second lieutenant up over $150,000 for a lieutenant colonel and above.
And the takeaway is always the same. The base number is misleading, because military comp is built on allowances and bonuses. Housing allowance, which is tax-advantaged, flight pay, aviation bonuses, the retention bonuses can be enormous, plus the pension and the healthcare. A newly minted second lieutenant fighter pilot isn't getting rich on that base salary. but the total package plus the flight time and the eventual airline pipeline, that's the real compensation story.
The value's in the logbook and the benefits, not the paycheck.
The logbook, exactly. You're getting paid in fast jet time that's basically impossible to buy on the civilian side.
And then there's a genuinely delightful one. Flight trackers caught a pilot skywriting a message on a 2-hour test flight.
I saw this one, this is great.
A Revenair Piper Tomahawk out of Liverpool. John Lennon doing a mandatory post-maintenance test flight, and the pilot used the 2 hours to trace out on the flight tracking software the words, "I'm bored."
I'm bored. On the flight radar track, which honestly, respect. Because think about what a post-maintenance check flight actually is, right? You've got to fly the airplane through a defined profile to verify the maintenance, but a lot of it is just boring holes in the sky, running the systems, watching the gauges.
So he made art out of a required flight.
Made art out of it, and gave the flight tracking nerds a treat. Look, no harm done, it's a tomahawk over the English countryside, and it's a nice reminder that there are humans in these cockpits with a sense of humor. Loved it.
All right, we've got two from the video side, and I want to end the serious portion of the show on one of them, because it's an accident analysis and it matters. But let's do the lighter one first. There's a video on how a company, quote, lost its own fighter jet.
The FA-18 origin story, right?
The Hornet, yeah. It gets into the McDonnell Douglas and Northrop arrangement, which was one of the more contentious corporate deals in modern military procurement.
It's a great case study, actually. The short version is the Hornet grew out of the Northrop YF-17. And the way the prime and the partner divided up the Navy versus export rights got messy and litigious. You essentially had a situation where the company that originated the design ended up on the outside of the program that made it famous.
Hence, lost its own fighter jet.
Right. And the pilot's eye lesson is just how much of what airplane you end up flying is decided in boardrooms and contracts, not in engineering. The Hornet turned into this incredible multi-role workhorse, decades of service, and its origin is a corporate knife fight. Worth the watch if you like the industrial history.
Okay, now the one I really want to spend a minute on because it's a fatal accident and there are lessons in it. A 1978 Beechcraft Baron 55 crashed near Waterloo, Illinois on July 9th, killing the pilot Jimmy Don Lewis and his son Braden. They were returning from St. Louis at night.
Night and convective weather. I can already see where this is going and it's heartbreaking.
The aircraft encountered severe convective weather, and there was a loss of control.
So this is one of the most well-documented killers in all of general aviation, and it keeps happening. Night, plus thunderstorms, plus a capable but demanding airplane. The Baron's a great machine, but it's a high-performance twin, and it will not save you from flying into a convective cell.
Break down what actually goes wrong in that scenario.
So at night, you lose the visual cues. In the daytime, you can see the wall of a storm. You can see the rain shaft. You can pick your way around it visually as a last resort. At night, especially with any cloud around, you can fly right into the worst of it and not see it coming until you're in it.
And once you're in it?
Once you're in a mature convective cell, you've got severe turbulence, updrafts and downdrafts that can exceed the airplane's structural capability. You've got spatial disorientation because your instruments are going haywire and your inner ear is lying to you. And you can get into a loss of control upset that leads to an in-flight breakup or a graveyard spiral. And this is an instrument flight rules competent scenario that overwhelms even experienced pilots.
So what are the intervention points? Where does this chain get broken?
Way upstream. This is a pre-flight and en route decision, not a stick and rudder problem. The tools exist, right? You've got data link weather in the cockpit now, ADS-B weather, satellite weather. You've got NEXRAD radar. You've got flight service. You've got the convective outlooks. The single most important skill here is the willingness to not go, or to divert early, or to sit on the ground in St. Louis for another 2 hours and let the line pass.
And there's the get-home-itis factor, flying at night to get back.
That's the human element, and it's the real killer. Night, end of a trip, you want to get home, your kid's in the airplane. The weather looks like it might be okay if you hurry. Every one of those pressures pushes you toward launching. And the discipline is to recognize that convective weather plus night plus wanting to get home is a lethal combination, and the airplane doesn't care about your schedule.
Data link weather into the cockpit has a specific trap here too, doesn't it? The latency.
Huge point. NEXRAD in the cockpit is not real time. It can be several minutes old, sometimes more, and a fast developing cell can grow dramatically in that gap. So people use Datalink Radar for tactical, close-in avoidance, and it burns them because the cell they're threading is bigger and closer than the picture shows. Datalink is a strategic, big-picture tool. Stay far away from the weather. It is not for picking your way between cells at close range.
That is such an important distinction. Strategic avoidance, not tactical penetration.
Strategic, always. 20 miles from a cell, minimum, and more at night. And look, our condolences to the Lewis family, genuinely. A father and son. The reason we talk through these is so the lessons don't die with them. If one pilot listening tonight decides to sit on the ground and wait out a line instead of pressing, that's the whole point of doing this.
Well said. All right, that's going to bring us to the end of the brief for today, July 14th. Big picture, the supersonic regulatory shift is real momentum, but it's the start of a long road. Starlink just doubled your connectivity bill, and the enduring lessons on weight and weather and night flying are, unfortunately, as relevant as ever.
Yeah, and if you take one thing today, let it be the barren discussion. Convective weather at night, strategic avoidance, wide margins, and the willingness to just not go. That one's free and it saves lives.
For those of you heading to Oshkosh next week, safe travels, go find the NBAA tent and enjoy Air Venture.
And to our friends flying into Paris this morning, may your holding fuel be plentiful and your in-flight entertainment be working.
For Sam and myself, thanks for flying with us. This has been Flight Logic Brief. Keep it safe out there. We'll see you tomorrow morning.
Blue skies, everybody.